The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. And, of course, we'll be reading from this Friday's edition, dated July 22nd, 2011. And the first item from the main story of The Week magazine this week, no grand bargain on the debt ceiling. What happened? Negotiations over raising the nation's debt ceiling failed to break a partisan deadlock this past week as Republicans rejected President Obama's offer to forge a grand bargain that would cut $4 trillion from the deficit over 10 years through spending cuts, Social Security and Medicare reform, and tax increases. House Speaker John Boehner, Republican from Ohio, initially seemed open to Obama's offer, but pulled out of talks last weekend when his caucus objected to raising about $1 trillion in new revenue over a decade by removing tax breaks for oil companies, corporate jet owners, and hedge fund managers. Washington has a spending problem, Boehner said. We don't have a revenue problem. Republicans are now seeking a smaller deal to cut $2.5 trillion in spending without any revenue increases, but the president was holding out for a big deal to repair the nation's long-term fiscal imbalance. The nation's imbalance is continuing. We might as well do it now. Pull off the Band-Aid, eat our peas, Obama said. With no sign the impasse will be broken, Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, proposed a last-chance option to stave off government default. His plan would give the president authority to raise the debt ceiling in three smaller increments over the course of the year without congressional approval. That would put the burden of responsibility for raising the nation's debt squarely on Obama. The president dismissed the offer as partisan politics and warned that if Congress fails to raise the debt ceiling by August 2nd and the government goes into its first default in history, checks might not go out to recipients of Social Security, military pensions, and other government benefits. Now here's what the editorials had to say. If you're wondering who is responsible for this mess, said the Boston Globe, blame the voters. If either party touches entitlements, George W. Bush in 2006, congressional Democrats with Obama's health care reform plan in 2010, they lose the following election, and the reckless spending goes on. And whenever a minority party takes a strictly obstructionist position, as the Republicans did last year, the voters reward them for it. Obama's grand bargain was a trap, said the Wall Street Journal. Obama claims he's willing to cut entitlements, but he has taken what may be the costliest one of all, Obamacare, off the table. To pay for that big government boondoggle, Democrats snuck in $900 billion in new health care related taxes over the next decade. And now Obama wants to add $1 trillion in additional taxes by closing so-called loopholes. Forget it. And now here's what the columnist said. It's become fashionable to say both sides are equally at fault for the deadlock, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. This is patently false. Obama proposed around $3 worth of budget cuts for every dollar of new revenue, and still Republicans rejected the offer. The GOP deserves the blame here for taking the absurd position that not a cent in new revenue can be raised, even if it's my closing loophole for the richest Americans. Clearly, no deal is possible, said John Pohoretz in CommentaryMagazine.com. That being the case, Republicans should embrace McConnell's fiendishly clever proposal. It allows the GOP to claim responsibility for breaking the deadlock and also to attack Obama for the ever-increasing debt ceiling right up until the 2012 elections. If it had been up to Boehner and Obama alone, said David Brooks in the New York Times, that big deal would have been possible. They both understand you need bipartisan cover if you really want to cut spending and reform entitlements and the tax code as well. Sadly, they are bracketed on all sides by partisan extremists who see politics as warfare. It really is starting to look like a stalemate, said Ezra Klein in the Washington Post, with Republicans digging in their heels on tax increases and Obama refusing to cut spending without some increases in revenues. Only two developments can force someone to blink: public fury arising out of a government shutdown, or a market panic arising out of a near default. And the latest news on this whole subject is that a bipartisan group has come up with plans that are encouraging to the president, and that, of course, prompted a large increase in the stock market value. The Dow Jones Industrial Average went up over 200 points on Tuesday of this week. There'll be more details in the news and in next week's edition of The Week magazine. Our next item from the main story section: more jobs misery. Only 18,000 jobs were created last month, the Department of Labor reported, sparking new concerns that the feeble U.S. recovery has ground to a dead stop. The number was far below the 125,000 new jobs needed to keep pace with population growth. Unemployment rose to 9.2%, and almost half of the 14 million jobless have now sought work for 6 months or longer. President Obama said the anemic hiring proved that the recovery from the Great Recession had a long way to go, but he said that Congress could spur job creation right now by passing measures he's recommended, including patent reform and the creation of a new infrastructure bank. Republican House Speaker John Boehner blamed Obama, saying that his stimulus spending binge and new federal regulations were wrecking the economy. Boehner is right to pin this indescribably grim jobs report on Obama's love of red tape, said Irwin Stelzer in the Weekly Standard. His administration has blocked oil drilling, costing 100,000 jobs. He's banned companies from using unpaid interns, denying teens the chance to gain vital work experience. And then there is Obamacare, which discourages small businesses from hiring out of fear that they'll be hit with huge health care bills. The good news? Those policies can be reversed when Obama is booted from office. It's bizarre to hear Republicans condemning the crisis that they helped to create and are refusing to fix, said the New York Times in an editorial. Cutbacks in state and local spending have caused about 1 million public sector layoffs over the past 2 years. Those losses could have been avoided if the GOP had given up its ideological goal of cutting spending when we needed it most. We're in for years of high unemployment, and we'd better get used to it, said Peter Orszag in Bloomberg.com. Recoveries following financial collapses tend to be frailer than those associated with normal cyclical downturns. Some countries in similar straits have experienced unemployment rates 5 points above normal for a decade. Our best hope now is to be as bold as we can in boosting hiring and cutting the deficit, but we have to steel ourselves to the prospect that we're in for a real hard slog. The next item from the main story section: slashing aid for Pakistan. Frustrated with Pakistan's uncooperative behavior, the Obama administration announced it would hold back $800 million of the $2 billion it grants the country in annual military aid. Administration officials said Pakistan has been expelling U.S. Special Forces advisors and arresting Pakistanis who helped the U.S. prepare its raid on Osama bin Laden's Abbottabad hideout back in May. They also said Pakistan's military refuses to purge itself of Taliban collaborators or conduct operations against Afghan rebels in North Waziristan. Until we get through these difficulties, said White House Chief of Staff William Daley, we'll hold back some of the money that the American taxpayers have committed to give. Bravo, said Investor's Business Daily in an editorial. It's time for Pakistan to show its cooperation is more than just a facade to milk the U.S. for cash. Sure, the Pakistanis have immediately begun huffing and puffing, saying they'll turn to China instead, but that's nothing new. They may already be using USAID to buy Chinese nukes. And our generals say the Pakistani government sanctioned the torture and killing of reporter Saeed Shahzad after he revealed that Pakistan supports the Taliban in Quetta and the Haqqani group operating out of the Pakistan's tribal region. But withholding aid could backfire, said Tony Karen in Time.com. Pakistanis see the Taliban as their proxy in a struggle with arch-rival India for control of Afghanistan. In their view, Hamid Karzai's beleaguered government there could end up as a puppet regime of India. Meanwhile, the Pakistani public is furious over U.S. drone strikes on Pakistani soil, so no one should be surprised if Pakistan's response to Washington anteing up is not to fold, but rather to double down. Exactly, said the Peshawar, Pakistan Frontier Post, our overstretched military cannot afford to pile up more load on its back by taking on phantom militants in North Waziristan. This American money just replaces what we have to spend ourselves on the American war. We should refuse to fight against our own interests and forego this mythical U.S. aid. And now the controversy of the week in the Week magazine, Murdoch, an emperor meets his Waterloo. At last, Rupert Murdoch is reaping what he sowed, said Carl Bernstein in Newsweek. The global media empire of the man who made billions on cutthroat tabloid journalism in Britain, Australia, and the U.S. has been shaken to its foundation by revelations of widespread phone hacking by his tabloid newspapers in Britain. More than 4,000 people had phone messages stolen by Murdoch's reporters, including a murdered girl, soldiers killed in Iraq and Afghanistan, and terrorist victims, to feed the scandal machine, his News of the World, and other newspapers, hired private detectives and bribed cops to dig up dirt. Investigators are targeting current and former Murdoch top aides, and if the 80-year-old Murdoch is finally nearing the end of his reign as the global king of media, it'll be sweet justice. No one over the past half century has had a more degrading impact upon our media and political culture. In the U.S., the low journalism and celebrity fixation of his trashy New York Post infected other media like a contagion, while Fox News, a cynical exercise in overt political bias, turned cable TV and American politics itself into a realm of unthinking polarization, sensationalism, and manufactured controversy. Rupert Murdoch didn't invent tabloid culture, said A.C. Grayling in the New York Times, but he did perfect it and turned it into a tool of political power. In Britain, he's used his newspapers to influence every general election since 1979, and he shamelessly leveraged that clout to advance his business and political interests. Murdoch spoke to Prime Minister Tony Blair three times in the 10 days that led up to the Iraq invasion of 2003, said the London Observer in an editorial. If Fox News helps defeat Barack Obama and elect a Republican president, Murdoch will certainly be on the phone to the Oval Office calling in favors and shaping policy. The man is a bit of a brute, said Roger Cohen in the New York Times, but on balance, he's been good for the media and more open world. With his evident loathing for elites, he's used no-holds-barred journalism to break down social barriers, and he has consistently been ahead of the curve with new technology, from satellites to cable TV to the Internet. Murdoch is a quintessential anti-establishment figure, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com, and only he had the resources and the guts to break the liberal monopoly of the mainstream media here in the U.S. That explains the lynch mob of pundits and commentators now baying for his blood. Still, the end of his reign is in sight, said Charles Moore in the London Telegraph. Even those of us who view him as an evil genius should recognize the tragedy here, because the truth is that the man has, as we used to say, ink in his veins. When everyone else gave up on print, Murdoch kept the faith. betting billions that people would still want newspapers. And in the end, it was newspapers that did him in, said David Carr in the New York Times. The phone hacking scandal was brought to light not by police investigation or a government inquiry, but by the dogged work of The Guardian in London. With a steady accretion of fact, that newspaper proved that phone hacking, wiretapping, and bribery were not the work of a few bad apples, as Murdoch and his minions insisted, but products of an amoral and ruthless culture that permeated his newsrooms right up to the top. Now that the hunter has become the hunted, how does it feel, Mr. Murdoch? And now from the Week magazine, we will turn to the popular section entitled Good Week 4 and Bad Week 4. Always interesting. It was a good week for C-sections after Janet Johnson of Longview, Texas, gave birth by cesarean section to a 16-pound, 2-foot-long baby, believed to be the largest baby ever born in the state. It was a good week for quiet dinners after Mike Vwick, owner of McDane's Restaurant in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, announced that he was banning children under 6 because parents no longer try to keep fussing kids quiet. You know their child is the center of the universe, Vwick said. And it was a good week for visual aids after Dr. William Phillips halted his lecture at a Maine hospital about coronary heart disease when an audience member complained of chest pains and collapsed. Phillips and nurses restarted the man's heart. I think people will remember the lecture forever, Phillips said. It was a bad week for safe driving after Miami officials said they would furlough some city workers because penalties from red light cameras fell $8 million short of their $10 million forecast. It was a bad week for gun safety after Arizona State Senator Lori Klein answered a reporter's question about the pink handgun she carries into the Capitol by pointing it at his chest. Klein admitted the gun was loaded and had no safety, but said, "I just didn't have my hand on the trigger." And it was a bad week for Megan Blanchard, a country singer, who called Prince William a douche when performing for him and his wife in Prince Edward Island. "I mixed up Duke and Duchess, and it came out douche," Blanchard explained. "It'll be something to tell the kids, that's for sure." And now let's turn to the People's section of the Week magazine for this week, July 22nd, 2011. Our first item, the private eye who wears a skull cap. "Joe Levin isn't your typical private investigator," said Jed Lipinski in the New York Times. "An Orthodox Jew, Levin has carved a niche for himself investigating various Orthodox-related crimes and infidelities. A decade ago, he started his company, TOT Private Investigation, and began trailing his subjects around the world from synagogues to strip clubs. The company's acronym stands for a Yiddish expression. It means put your tukas on the table," says Levin. "In other words, show me the proof," though he typically wears the fedora and the black frock of the Hasidim. He sometimes dons stocking caps and sports jerseys as disguises. He knows the unspoken codes of the community, which enables him to infiltrate insular Orthodox groups without raising eyebrows. It's an advantage that works every day except the Sabbath, when he hires non-Jews to fill in until sundown. "Saturday is a very busy day for mischief inside the Hasidic world. Everyone thinks we're sleeping, but in reality, we're wide awake. Investigating wrongdoing," he concedes, "can be distressing for a man of faith. I want to believe that there are good people in the world, but when I go to work every day and I see what I see, it's a very big challenge for me." The next item, Timberlake's thick skin. Justin Timberlake can take it on the chin, said David Hockman in Playboy. Today, the 30-year-old singer and actor gets George Clooney-like attention from women and has sold millions of records, but he hasn't always been so popular. His boy band, NSYNC, was once nearly booed from the stage when it opened for heavy rock acts. It was literally raining beer cans and glass bottles the whole time from 500,000 people who wanted to see AC/DC and not My Sorry Ass. Growing up in small-town Tennessee, he alienated everyone with his musical tastes. Not a lot of 10-year-old Caucasian kids were running around Millington, Tennessee, singing Stevie Wonder and Al Green songs. I wasn't cool with the white kids because they thought I wanted to be black. And I wasn't cool with the black kids because they thought I wanted to be black. Lately, he takes a beating on gossip websites where he's often blamed for breaking the hearts of several high-profile girlfriends. The Internet is a cruel place, he sighs. I don't know who sits around behind a computer screen making this stuff up, but you just have to shut it off. My life is not on the Internet. And our next item, about Halle Berry from the gossip section in the week. Halle Berry had a close encounter with a stalker this week, said eonline.com. A man who allegedly invaded her property three times was arrested by Los Angeles police after he scaled a wall surrounding the actress's home. Berry first spotted a man police later identified as Richard Franco peering at her through a window last Saturday, and he returned the next day. Berry's security team caught Franco on his third intrusion onto the property. Franco, who has prior convictions for car theft, vandalism, and drug use, was taken into custody by police and is being held on $150,000 bond. And that's from the People section of the Week magazine for this week. You're listening to our regular reading of the Week magazine. Thanks for joining me today. And now let's turn to the briefing section from the week. This week's entitled, The New Gas Boom. The U.S. has a mammoth deposit of natural gas that could fuel the country for decades. Can it be safely extracted? Well, how much gas is there? About as much in terms of available energy as Saudi Arabia's remaining oil reserves, enough to change America's energy equation for decades. The largest deposit is in the Marcellus Shale, which extends from New York's Finger Lakes region through Pennsylvania and as far south as Kentucky. The Marcellus Shale, a brittle layer of rock more than a mile underground, is the geological remnant of an ancient sea, and is laced with pockets of trapped gas, which is mostly methane. Penn State geologist Terry Engelder, a lifelong student of the Marcellus Shale, says it could contain as much as 516 trillion cubic feet of natural gas. That would make it the second largest gas field in the world, with 20 times our current annual national consumption of natural gas. With additional large shale gas deposits now being explored and tapped in Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Oklahoma, the Department of Energy late last year more than doubled its estimate of technically recoverable domestic reserves of gas to 827 trillion cubic feet. How would the gas be used? A vast new supply of natural gas would not only provide energy for heating homes, but would also substantially replace dirty coal and foreign oil in generating electricity. It could even serve as a fuel source in a new generation of cars and trucks. The potential for natural gas is enormous, President Obama recently said. Why did he use the word potential? Well, much of the shale gas may never leave the ground. The process of removing pockets of natural gas from the layers of shale, called fracking, is extraordinarily complex and has generated intense environmental and political opposition. That process, already used in thousands of wells, begins with drilling, sometimes miles deep into the shale, and then using new techniques horizontally through it for as much as another mile. Then comes hydraulic fracturing, or fracking as they call it. A mixture of water, sand, and a toxic brew of chemicals is pumped into the wells as tremendous pressure, fracturing the rock and then keeping the fissures open so that the previously trapped natural gas can flow up to the wellhead. So what are the dangers? The biggest concern is the depletion and contamination of water supplies. Fracking a single well takes an average of 2 million gallons of water a day, much of it drawn from local aquifers. Roughly half the fracking water comes back up the well, rife with chemicals and sometimes carrying traces of radiation from underground rocks. Municipal purification plants can't deal with that wastewater, so much of it remains stored in plastic-lined ponds near the wellheads. Some have already leaked and contaminated groundwater and streams. Environmentalists also contend that the mixture of chemicals and water injected underground can leak from pipes on the way back up and contaminate underground aquifers that provide drinking water with both toxins and methane. In a heavily drilled region in Demock, Pennsylvania, one resident's well exploded in 2009, and state officials found that the aquifer had been contaminated with methane and heavy metals. Resident Craig Sautner says his children got dizzy and developed sores just from taking showers. "Our land is worthless," he says. What is the industry's response to all of this? Well, it acknowledges that some accidents have occurred, but insists that fracking does not contaminate aquifers and wells. The shale formations where fracking fluids are injected, the industry says, are usually located hundreds of feet below aquifers, which are separated from the shale by layers of impermeable rock. In a narrow sense, the industry is right. Federal Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Lisa Jackson told Congress in May that she was not aware of any proven case where the fracking process itself had contaminated drinking water. But several academic and journalistic studies have found hundreds of instances in which chemicals and methane infiltrated groundwater near fracking sites. With environmental activists, fractivists as they're called, leading the opposition, the industry is on the defensive. The opposition has been out in front of the shale gas issue, acknowledged Jack Williams, president of Exxon Shale Gas Unit, XTO Energy. Who will win the battle? That may largely depend on a major study of fracking's impact on drinking water that's now underway. At the request of Congress, the EPA is conducting the study and is expected to provide a preliminary report by the end of next year. Few expect the EPA to recommend banning fracking altogether, since the U.S. is in desperate need of jobs and economic development, as well as domestic sources of energy. It's much more likely that the EPA will recommend more stringent regulation of the industry to minimize the impact on water supplies, while allowing fracking to continue. All energy sources have potentially harmful side effects, says Michael Lind of the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan public policy institute. Solar and wind power won't even come close to meeting the nation's needs, he says, so the age of natural gas has only just begun. And now the cutout section with some additional information on this new gas boom subject is entitled Why States Support Fracking. If it can be safely extracted, a big if, natural gas actually offers significant environmental benefits over other fossil fuels. Natural gas is the cleanest burning fossil fuel, producing 45% less carbon dioxide than coal and 30% less than oil. Using natural gas instead of those fuels would thus, in theory, reduce the U.S.'s output of greenhouse gases linked to climate change. Tapping the U.S.'s shale gas would also produce major economic benefits. The extraction process is labor-intensive, generating lots of high-paying jobs and It also provides payments of thousands of dollars in leases and royalties to the landowners, mostly in economically depressed rural areas. Pennsylvania's Department of Labor recently said fracking for Marcellus shale gas had generated 48,000 new hires in that state in just 18 months. In hopes of a similar boom, the New York Governor Andrew Cuomo just lifted a moratorium on fracking in his state while banning it from regions containing critical watersheds and aquifers. And now from the Week magazine for this week, let's turn to the section entitled The Best Columns in the U.S. as Determined by the Week. Our first one is entitled Why We Don't Need Cayley's Law. And this was written by Peter Finocchiaro in Salon.com. Beware of laws that are named after murdered children, said Peter Finocchiaro. The latest in a long line of these laws created to satisfy public outrage is Cayley's Law, which would make it a crime for a parent to wait more than an hour to report the death of a child to police. The proposed law is a direct response to the acquittal of Casey Anthony in the death of her 2-year-old daughter Cayley, who was missing for 31 days before police were notified. More than 1 million Americans have signed an online petition demanding that Congress pass Cayley's Law, but other laws like it have proved to be ineffective and even counterproductive. Take Megan's Law, which required the creation of vast databases of everyone convicted of a sex crime. As a result, more than 670,000 Americans have been classified as sex offenders. Some of them were teenagers convicted of having sex with their girlfriends or men caught urinating in public. Cayley's Law would be just as misguided and wouldn't prevent a single child's murder. The government shouldn't create a law because a mob of angry people wish that Casey Anthony were still in jail. The next column, Bachman's Submissive Problem, written by Jill Lawrence in TheDailyBeast.com. Can a woman who has vowed to be submissive to her husband serve as leader of the free world? Asked Jill Lawrence. That question will now hang over the campaign of U.S. Representative Michelle Bachmann, a leading Republican presidential contender who professes to live by the word of the Bible. In a 2006 speech at a Minneapolis megachurch, it was revealed last week, Bachmann recounted how her husband had told her to become a tax lawyer and then to run for Congress. She wanted to do neither. But the Lord says, be submissive, Bachmann told the audience and then quoted the Bible. Wives, you are to be submissive to your husbands. Like most highly religious candidates, Bachmann has learned to be bilingual, speaking publicly in the language of politics and using the special language of her faith with select audiences. But her biblical description of her marriage is now in the public realm, and talk of wifely submission will not go over well with moderate Republican women or most female voters. Inquiring minds will want to know who will be making the decisions in a Bachmann White House, the elected president or her husband. And the third column from this week from the Week magazine, A Sobering Lesson for School Reform, written by Paul Tuff in the New York Times Magazine. No excuses, that said Paul Tuff, used to be the rallying cry of the education reform movement back when it insisted that kids from low-income families could be taught to read, do math, and test as well as kids from affluent suburbs. That goal fueled a decade of major education initiatives, including more charter schools. But a decade later, even the most celebrated charter schools are falling far short of the test scores achieved in top public schools. Take Urban Prep Academy in Chicago and the Bruce Randolph School in Denver, which have been singled out as models by the Obama administration. Just 17% of Urban Prep students passed the statewide achievement test last year, while at Bruce Randolph, just 15% of ninth grade students met reading proficiency standards. But hey, say reformers, those percentages are better than those at the worst public schools. Comparing test scores of poor urban kids to affluent white kids, they say, is like comparing apples and oranges. Sounds like an excuse to me, the writer says. The truth is that successfully educating large numbers of low-income kids is very, very hard, and that good teachers alone can't erase the disadvantages of poverty. And now we'll flip back to the back of the magazine, the Week magazine, that is, to the last word. This one is entitled, The Making of the Godfather. It's now considered a movie classic, says Peter Bart, but the filming was a fiasco of ego and insecurity. From the moment The Godfather hit the bestseller list early in 1969, Bob Evans and I knew that the rules of the game would change. As the heads of production at Paramount, we had been dealing with this underdog project, a manuscript by an obscure author, Mario Puzo, which had been transformed into a gripping screenplay by a still obscure writer-director, Francis Coppola. But now The Godfather had become, by Hollywood standards, a hot property. I suppose we should be thrilled about this, I told Evans, but I feel a chill, not a thrill. Within days, my chill seemed prescient. Million-dollar offers to buy the book arrived from top producers like Dino De Laurentiis and stars like Burt Lancaster. Next came the second guessing from the hierarchs in New York. Every top executive at Paramount and at Gulf and Western, the parent company, was now poring through The Godfather and knew exactly who should direct the film and star in it. When I reminded everyone that Coppola was already working on the script, the news elicited a uniform indifference. Why put a lightweight director on a heavyweight film, I was asked. My colleagues had also conveniently forgotten that I had assigned the producing job to Albert S. Ruddy, a savvy young producer who I felt had the toughness and dedication to pull off what was becoming an increasingly controversial subject. Ruddy, a tall, shambling guy who affected a mobster-like voice, had a great appreciation of the absurd and a willingness to laugh off setbacks, traits that would save us both. Our plan was to bring in The Godfather for somewhere between $5 and $6 million. The key was to forge an inexpensive deal with Marlon Brando, whose career was ice cold, then bring aboard some gifted young actors to fill out the cast. When this plan became public, other better casting ideas again came pouring in. Various agents proposed everyone from Sonny Tufts to Anthony Quinn to play Vito Corleone. As weeks of indecision rolled by, it became clear that the company had been immobilized by the dazzling worldwide success of the novel. It's time to bite the bullet, I finally said to Evans. Let's send Coppola to talk to Bloodhorn. Charles Bloodhorn, the chairman of Gulf and Western, was known to his associates as the Führer. He was a coarse man with a guttural accent, frenzied energy, and the instincts of a true gambler. And then let's send in Ruddy, I said. We have a plan, so let's press all the buttons. A Charlie meeting will be a massacre, Evans replied. As it turned out, Bloodhorn reacted enthusiastically. Coppola eloquently spun out his approach to a father-son story, explaining how the creation of a mafia dynasty was analogous to the building of America. Ruddy was typically more direct. We're going to make a terrifyingly realistic movie about the kind of people you understand and love, he told the chairman. It was a calculated risk. Bloodhorn was sensitive about rumors that he was dealing with shady financiers who had ties to the mob, but he took it in good humor. The issue of casting was the next barrier. At the first mention of Brando's name, Bloodhorn launched into a tirade that he was box office poison. When Coppola said he favored Al Pacino for the role of Michael, Stanley Jaffe, the 30-year-old president of Paramount, snorted that the Pacino kid was too young and inexperienced. Evans advocated Jimmy Caine, a con, rather, for Michael Corleone. Bluedorn proposed Charlie Bronson for Vito, and again, chaos prevailed. Offers went out to Jack Nicholson, David Carradine, even Danny Thomas. Screen tests were shot in New York with a range of film and TV actors. Coppola confided to me that he had organized his own surreptitious screen tests in San Francisco and had invited Jimmy Caan, Al Pacino, Robert Duvall, and Diane Keaton to participate. Next, Coppola tried an even shrewder ploy. He went to Brando's house on Mulholland Drive atop Hollywood with a skeleton crew telling the actor that he wanted to shoot some trial footage in an effort to get a take on the character of the Godfather. Brando, attired in a kimono to conceal his girth, welcomed the young director. He had read the book again and felt that whoever played the part, the actor should speak in a slurred manner. He had been shot in the throat at one time, and his soft, gravelly voice would carry more authority. To Coppola's delight, Brando had started to get into his part. He stuffed Kleenex into his mouth, causing his jaw to jut out. He blackened his hair with shoe polish and put on a jacket with a rolled back collar. When he started speaking his lines, Marlon Brando had become the Godfather. Brando was offered actor scale up front and 5% of gross receipts when the film grossed $50 million. Brando's attorney, Norman Gary, pleaded for at least $100,000 to help the actor avoid tax delinquency. In exchange, Brando agreed to return his points in the movie, a deal which would ultimately cost him at least $11 million. Still, no one could agree on the rest of the cast. Coppola, having won on Brando, was vehemently demanding Al Pacino for the pivotal role of Michael. Evans disagreed. "The guy's no gangster," Evans told Coppola. With 4 weeks left before the start of shooting, the debate continued. Evans realized he had no movie unless he gave his blessing to Pacino, but insisted that Caan get the role of Sonny. In March 1971, Coppola was finally given the green light to shoot his film. Coppola had won most of his casting battles, yet he still understandably felt under siege. His cinematographer, Gordon Willis, was innovative but cantankerous. His editor, Aram Avakian, was secretive and vaguely critical. Then there were rumblings from the mob itself. Several of the bad boys found their way onto the set. A peace treaty was arranged, but Evans received a threatening phone call and a bomb scare cleared out the Gulf and Western building. The atmosphere on the set was chaotic. Coppola's screenplay ran to 163 pages, which was roughly 40 pages too long. Willis, his cameraman, was behaving disrespectfully toward his director. "You're not using your actors right," he declared in a loud voice. Brando was mumbling his dialogue, still finding his way into the character. The next flashpoint was prompted by the dailies. The first scenes were so dark that both Evans and I simultaneously removed our glasses, checking that we hadn't been wearing sunglasses. "I can't understand Brando, and I can't see the actors. Other than that, the work is great," Evans said, his voice laden with sarcasm. As the movie moved into its second and third weeks, my primary concern was that Coppola was isolating himself. I called him every day in an effort to extend support. "If you want to go for that exaggerated dark look, why didn't you prepare us for it?" I asked "I'm on your side. I would have prepared my colleagues." "I'm fixing it." Willis is an expletive here that I won't repeat. "But he says you're one, too, and you fired him. Talk to people, Francis. This is not time to brood. It's time to lead." "Things are getting better," he replied, but they weren't. Members of the supporting cast were feeling the angst. Duvall told friends he was persuaded that Coppola would be fired within 2 or 3 weeks. Pacino was drinking heavily every night, convinced he would be fired the next day. The day after my conversation with Coppola, a palace coup broke out. To my astonishment, Jack Ballard, a Paramount executive, announced on a conference call that Coppola wasn't up to the job. He wanted Avakian, the editor, as the director. "What the hell's going on?" I demanded of Evans. "I'm not willing to throw Coppola to the wolves. Are you?" Evans seemed distracted. The whole situation is getting to be like a mafia plot, I continued. Ruddy's people in New York believe Avakian is sabotaging the dailies. Francis can deliver. I know he can, Evan said. We've got to restore order, otherwise the movie will unravel. Please call Coppola, I said. Tell him that the studio is behind him, and I'm telling Jack Ballard to crawl into an effing hole. While Evans may have had mixed feelings about his director, he now sprang into firm support mode. Not only did he calm the edgy Coppola with the appropriate reassurances, but he also told the corporate team to back off. Coppola responded well to Evans' vote of confidence. I visited the set fairly often now and was pleased by the emerging camaraderie. Coppola was managing Brando with special respect and patience. Francis is starting to act like a director, Ruddy told me, in good ways and bad ways. Evans and Coppola had differences about the running time of the movie. Coppola had delivered a print at 2 hours and 10 minutes, which Evans correctly felt was too stark. Coppola's curt response was that Evans wanted to add material that he had cut so Evans could claim credit for saving the movie. Coppola went into an angry sulk. Evans had become obsessive about the subtle moments and nuances in the film that the director had overlooked in his editing. He felt that if he could seclude himself in an editing room, his vision of The Godfather would be vastly superior to the one that Coppola had delivered. You've delivered a trailer, not a movie, Evans snapped at one point. Bob Evans' ego is running rampant, Coppola told anyone who would listen, including the press. Though Evans had not previously suffered back pain, he was now in such agony that he needed to remain on a hospital-type gurney. The bed was wheeled in and out of the editing room, where Evans remained during 18-hour days. Back in San Francisco, Coppola read an item in a gossip column about Evans' new mission in life, that he was working night and day to salvage The Godfather. Coppola reacted by firing off an irate letter, insisting that his film did not require salvaging. Steadfast, Evans kept working. Now and then, Coppola could glimpse some scenes and give his comments. A few times a week, Evans would summon me to the editing room, and he would exchange ideas. One evening, Evans and I ran about 90 minutes of the re-edited film. After the screening, we both sat in silence for a while. I think it's becoming a movie, he said. I was in a daze. It's really taking shape, I said in a non-committal voice. When I got home, I went to my den and tried to sort out my feelings. Amid all the noise and rancor, an absolutely brilliant movie was somehow coming together. Had I become lost in self-delusion? I wondered. Or was this nightmare somehow becoming a transcendent experience, one that could change the lives of everyone involved? I decided not to share my ruminations with any of my colleagues. And that was from The Infamous Players by Peter Bart. And, of course, it was reprinted by permission of Weinstein Books. And that was the last word from The Week magazine. Thanks for joining me today. We've got a few more minutes to go, so let's turn to talking points from The Week magazine for this week, July 22nd, 2011. The first item is entitled The Space Program, The Heavens Can Wait. The final frontier will have to wait, said Mitch Albom in the Detroit Free Press. When the space shuttle Atlantis touches down after its final mission, it will mark the end not only of the 30-year shuttle program, but also of all manned U.S. spaceflight for the foreseeable future. If the United States wants to send someone into space after this weekend, we'll have to buy him or her a ticket on Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic or start hitchhiking to the stars with the Russians. Given that the federal government doesn't even have enough money to sustain Social Security, said Phil Kadner in the Chicago Sun-Times, one can understand why President Obama scrapped NASA's plans to build a giant new rocket and return to the moon. But mark my words, killing the manned space program will turn out to be a false economy. Great nations have always done great things. When they stop trying, they stop being great. This is not a grim moment, but an amazing one for the U.S. space program, said Gareth Cook in the Boston Globe. We just need to embrace the era of robots. The fact is that we no longer need astronauts to explore the solar system or the stars. Look at Spirit and Opportunity, the two unmanned rovers that explored the surface of Mars for 6 years at a tiny fraction of what it would have cost to send astronauts there. During the dawn of the space age, manned spaceflight did serve a purpose, inspiring and unifying the nation. But the cheapest, safest, and most effective way to take the next steps looking for life on Mars and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn is with unmanned craft. The answer should be all of the above, said Newsday in an editorial. Low-cost satellites and probes must obviously play a major role, but Americans are a voyaging frontier people, and mastering the art of sending humans into space is a worthwhile end in itself. Besides, said the San Francisco Chronicle, the nation could use a boost right about now. Dreaming is free, so why don't President Obama and his science advisors at least lay out a vision for future missions and get the country excited again? Someday the economy will bounce back. Then it will be time for those thrilling words, 3, 2, 1. Our next item from Talking Points is climate change. Not so hot? Think the world is getting hotter? Think again, said Investors Business Daily in an editorial. A new study by U.S. and Finnish scientists has found that the world didn't warm as predicted between 1998 and 2008. Indeed, global temperatures actually dropped slightly between 2005 and 2008. The absence of warming came despite a steady increase in carbon dioxide emissions, which scientists have insisted all along would raise temperatures. The damning evidence should kill off the great global warming boondoggle, said James Dellingpole in the London Telegraph. But the warmists have developed a new theory to explain away the inconvenient truth. They claim that sulfur pollutants pumped out from China's coal-fired power plants are blocking sunlight from reaching the planet's surface, thereby offsetting the warming effect of CO2 emissions. In other words, man-made global cooling is canceling out man-made global warming. Quick, someone tell the polar bears they're going to live. Actually, the Chinese coal hypothesis is perfectly sound, said Andrew Friedman in the Washington Post. China's coal consumption more than doubled over the past decade as its economy boomed, accounting for a 26% increase in global coal use. Since China has such weak air pollution standards, its coal burning sent massive amounts of sun-blocking sulfates into the atmosphere. Unfortunately, all that sulfur dioxide also contributes to the production of acid rain, said Jamie Vernon in the DiscoverMagazine.com. Recognizing the damage this pollutant wreaks on their citizens' health, crops, and the environment, Chinese leaders have ordered coal plants to be fitted with sulfur-scrubbing equipment. Once that cleanup takes effect, the drop in sulfur particles could trigger a sudden and dramatic temperature rise as it unleashes the impact of rising CO2 levels that have been masked for a decade. And it gets worse, said Kevin Drum and Mother Jones. The most widely accepted climate change model predicts that a doubling of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere will cause global temperatures to climb by just under 3 degrees Celsius. But a recent paper in the American Journal of Science used a more finely tuned model based on historical data and found that a doubling of CO2 could produce a temperature increase of 6 to 8 degrees Celsius. That thermometer-shattering rise would result in mass extinctions, dead oceans, large-scale desertification, coastal cities underwater, and billions dead. Right now, we're on course for a doubling of CO2 before this century's end. Buckle your seatbelts. And the next item is handwriting no longer necessary? In a few decades, no one who grew up in Indiana will be able to sign his or her name, said Theodore Dalrymple in the Wall Street Journal, and that's because state officials have stopped requiring schools to teach third graders the art of cursive handwriting. The looping, joined-up letters that have stood for centuries as a sign of education and sophistication. Instead, students will be encouraged to focus on keyboard skills, on the principle that almost all writing today is done on computers and cell phones. Other states may soon follow, since the federal government's core standards for schools make no mention of cursive handwriting. This is sad and extremely short-sighted. Developing their own handwriting gives young people a powerful and tactile sense of their individuality and their character. And when these children grow up and have to sign a marriage certificate or will they need to hire an out-of-stater or immigrant to do it for them? And finally, smoking, fighting addiction with shock. A blackened lung, a rotting, sore-filled mouth, an addicted smoker exhaling through his tracheotomy hole. The images may be repulsive, said the New York Times in an editorial, but that's the point. Under new regulations, the Food and Drug Administration is requiring tobacco companies to adorn every cigarette pack with one of 9 graphic pictures showing in full color the consequences of smoking. Some 440,000 Americans still die from smoking each year, and graphic warning labels like these have reduced smoking rates in other countries. The tobacco companies have challenged the regulations in court, but the FDA should be commended, said the Philadelphia Inquirer. Smoking can kill you. People should be reminded of that. And now, as we run down for the last couple of minutes of the program, here are some shorter items. During President Obama's Twitter town hall just last week, questions sent on the social networking site were 140 characters or fewer. The president's oral responses were on average 2,099 characters long, the equivalent of 15 Twitter messages. Between 2004 and 2009, the median net worth of black households fell by 83%, according to a new analysis by the Economic Policy Institute. For white households, the median net worth fell 24%. And only 24% of teens ages 16 to 19 had summer jobs last year, the lowest rate since the government began keeping records in 1948. In 2001, 42% of teens in that age group had summer jobs, that according to the Wall Street Journal. And now let's take a look at Poll Watch for this week in the Week magazine. To save money in recent months, 67% of Americans say they have been buying more generic brands, and 46% say they've been bringing their lunch to work. 31% have canceled one or more magazine subscriptions. 22% have canceled or cut back on cable television service. And 21% have stopped buying coffee in the morning. And 58% of Americans say one or two children is the ideal size for a family. 33% say three or more children are really the ideal number. And we've just about run out of time for today's episode of the Week magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. Thanks for joining me. I'm George Douglas, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast right after the broadcast. So long until next time.